The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're talking to Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. Together we're answering your questions. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. And a reminder, you can send us questions to a radio program at AOL.com. Take your best shots, fire away, and we'll try to answer as accurately and comprehensively as we can to the best of our ability. So what's our next question, Layla?
Our next question is from Richard. Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. You have discussed the concept of combining foods in a meal to decrease glycemic load. Can activities following a meal also be adjusted to help keep blood glucose down? For instance, following a meal, I sometimes get a little drowsy. Is it good in terms of insulin release and digestion in general for me to give in to this desire and take a nap? Or should I do the opposite and go for a walk?
Well, yeah, this is going to be, you know, sort of a philosophical dissertation here, because I don't know that there is one set answer on that. There is a tendency, and I experienced it the other day. I made a delicious meatloaf. It was with grass-fed beef, and I put in mushrooms, I put in carrots, I put in onions, and garlic, and spices, and poured like half a bottle of tomato sauce on top and just stuck in the oven. And man, was that good. It was so good. And I'm going to admit, I had three pieces. I was going to have one, maybe two, but I had to have a third piece. Well, after that, I just felt like, oh, I got hit by a mallet. I mean, it was not an unpleasant sensation. It was that kind of like Thanksgiving feeling. And literally, I just lay down, close my eyes, and I was blissfully gone for about a half an hour. And this is what happens to, you know, you see these, you know, wildlife shows. I mean, they used to be these wild. I don't know if there still are wildlife shows, but we used to watch them when we were kids. And, you know, you see the lion devour its prey. Yeah, Wild Kingdom, right? Remember that? The lion would devour its prey and then climb up in a tree and then just sack out, you know, because that's such a massive intake of food, and that's the way that carnivores, certain animals, eat. And to some extent, humans can eat that way. But, you know, what happens when you have such a big meal is that you literally steal blood from your brain, you get into a parasympathetic state, and you get tired. So that's one of the reasons why it's probably not a great idea to have three pieces of meatloaf before you go to a spin class, you know?
But you know what? I like that you make that distinction between that, the blood leaving the brain, and the distinction between that and glycemic load.
Yes.
Your meatloaf was not a high glycemic load.
No, it was relatively fatty.
It was simply a big meal.
Protein and fat,
Right.
So, but you talk a little bit about the glycemic load effects. That's something else. Go ahead with that.
Yeah. Well, the glycemic load effect is about combining a meal so that, for instance, you could take a baked potato, plain, or a bagel, plain, or with jam on it, and that's got like the highest glycemic index. But we can lower that load, the glycemic load, by adding some protein and fat to it. On a baked potato, you may add butter, sour cream, maybe both. On that bagel,
to slow its absorption, calories.
Right. Now, Richard's question is: Can you substitute an activity? I guess maybe to have a higher glycemic meal, would it lower the load of it? I don't think that quite works the same way.
Yeah, but you know there is this phenomenon which is, and I don't quite understand the physiology of it, but you know, sometimes you have a big meal and it's like, oh, let's not take a cab home. Let's walk home. Just walk it off. Let's walk it off. And some of it is the idea that, you know, to some extent you're burning off the calories, but also it seems to aid digestion. You know, not if like very intense exercise.
Reduce the feeling of fullness, reducing that uncomfortable feeling of fullness.
Yeah. Right. Take a stroll, you know, look in the windows on Fifth Avenue or Madison Avenue and, you know, just kind of aid the digestion. But when it comes to, I'm not exactly sure what that level of exertion does to blood sugar.
Right.
I think what it probably does is it counteracts that parasympathetic tendency to go into a relaxation response, because the exercise is more of a sympathetic activity. It activates the sympathetic nervous system, and it may counteract the drowsiness. Although you with a big meal, you're sort of fighting, because exercise wants to go one direction and digestion wants to go another direction. So you can't do really heavy exercise after a big meal.
Right, right. But maybe a small stroll. And for anybody who's getting into the takeout coma, is what we call it.
Right.
That's when you're ordering in your Chinese and your fast food and whatever, and then falling asleep on the couch. It may be in your best interest to take a little stroll after a meal like that, because that's a powerful meal.
Yeah. And by the way, I think it's also kind of a warning sign. If you find that that's what's happening, you probably ate too much. I got the other 2/3 of that meatloaf sitting in the refrigerator. I'm going to be a little bit more abstemious about that meatloaf.
You know what? Cold meatloaf is also delicious.
Oh, my God. It's, yes.
Oh, yeah. Killer. It's like cold roast chicken.
Right.
It's delicious.
And by the way, this is a low-carb meatloaf, because a lot of meatloafs are made with breadcrumbs. Or alternatively, if you can't handle wheat, you can get gluten-free breadcrumbs. Or you can make it with rice. The only carb that's in there is some, used a grater and I shaved down about 2 or 3 carrots. So there is some carbs in it, but it's, that's...
Oh, that's nothing in a whole meatloaf.
Yeah, it was 2-pound meatloaf, 2 pounds of meat. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Delicious.
Yeah.
Thank you for your very interesting question, Richard.
Yeah. the moral of the story is, if you have too much meatloaf, you'll loaf. No, that's...
Everybody's getting ready for Thanksgiving with that one. Anyway,
yep.
Our next question comes from Mary. My mother is 92 years old and suffers from vascular dementia. My concern
Let's hit pause on that.
Yeah.
What is vascular dementia? Let me explain. I think you know as well, Layla. Mm-hmm. There's dementia that's Alzheimer's, which is... frankly, I don't think there's a clear dividing line in the elderly between vascular dementia and Alzheimer's dementia. But vascular dementia usually occurs later. Alzheimer's you can get when you're, 40. It's like a amyloid deposition disease. It's usually associated with poor circulation. But it's not just about poor circulation. It's a progressive disease where the brain, get all the nerves get tangled up, and there's a lot of destruction. Tau proteins get deposited, and there's like gunk in your brain. Vascular dementia is what happens when you have poor circulation, possibly a series of mini strokes that create what are called lacunes, which is a French word for lakes or little holes, like Swiss cheese holes in your brain. And then your brain volume decreases and your thinking and movement abilities are impaired. And it's a real common problem because, we have, vascular disease of the heart, we have vascular disease of the brain.
Wow. Yeah.
So anyway.
So Mary's concern about her 92-year-old mother is that she's on a baby aspirin regimen to prevent strokes, which are prevalent in their family.
Right.
But she's wondering, could the vitamin K act as a blood coagulant and interfere with the aspirin therapy?
Absolutely not. Yeah. So let's explain, and we've explained this a lot, but I keep reiterating it. And here's the thing. One of the things that I'd like to – I have an idea for a column, which is X number of things that doctors get wrong about nutrition. And
that's a great idea.
Yeah, and so nobody steal that idea before I write it. It's going to take me a couple of weeks, but I'll write it. But one of the things that they get wrong is they believe vitamin K, we learned in medical school, it actually comes from the German word for coagulation. But in German, it's Coagulation, like with a K, right? Because this German C is a K. So they call it vitamin K because it helps your blood coagulate. It also does other things. It actually helps to protect the arteries, and it actually helps to mineralize bone as a companion for vitamin D. But so it's theoretically, you know, you take an aspirin to thin the blood, you don't want something that's going to make your blood coagulate. But here's the deal. Absence of vitamin K will cause your blood to be thin, but a superabundance of vitamin K will not make it overly thick. I mean, that's hard to get your head around. The only circumstance where vitamin K consumption might create a problem is if you're deliberately trying to thin your blood with one drug, which is Coumadin or warfarin, because that it neutralizes it. It will, you know, if you're trying to thin your blood out, vitamin K at high doses will mess up the effect of the Coumadin, and then you won't, your, in effect, your blood will come back to normal. It won't become hypercoagulable, it'll just come back to normal. And you don't want your blood to be normal because you want your blood to be thin under those circumstances.
Yeah. Okay. Very important question. Mary, best of luck with your mother. And thank you.
Yeah, it's okay to do it. It's, in fact, good for her. It's good for her because she's got, you know, elderly people also often have, we talked about the microbiome in part one. You know, they actually have damage to their microbiome, and they don't have as many bacteria. Vitamin K gets made in your gastrointestinal tract to some extent.
Yeah.
To some extent, it's dietary. Yep. You can get it dietarily from aged cheese or from a product like natto, which not a lot of Americans consume. It's popular in Japan.
Don't all newborns get a vitamin K shot?
Yeah, I think so, yes, because there's a possibility of some hemorrhagic disease. Hey, if that were the case, then all the newborns would be stroking out. They'd be having, you know, like blood clots. But no, they on the possibility that they might have thin blood, I believe that that's the case.
Yeah.
Yep. So anyway, so not a problem. In fact, beneficial. We have a lot of our patients taking vitamin K, and it's great when we have a patient who has both heart problems and they have osteoporosis, and we have double whammy when you give them vitamin K. Unless they're in Coumadin, then we have to be cautious about it.
Right. Very important vitamin K, especially for bone health, right, and cardiovascular. So, and we're finding out more and more about it, so it's very interesting as all the information comes to us.
Yep.
We've got a patient. We've got a question. Pardon me, from Joy. Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. I'm a 74-year-old healthy woman. No medication, just supplements. I love listening to your program. I learn a lot from you both. My B12. She has a high B12. She's got somewhat high LDL. She wants to gain weight. She's 112 pounds at 5'2".
Well, and that could be okay. That, we don't know what that
could be just fine. It's 74 years old, yeah.
You need a body comp to know if she's carrying excess body fat at that weight.
Exactly. Let me just give a little background on the rule for how we determine a proper weight for height. In women, and it's different for men, in women, for the first 5 feet of stature, you get 100 pounds. For every inch thereafter, you get 5 pounds.
Okay.
So at 5'2", 110 pounds would probably be optimal, but then we say plus or minus 10% depending on frame size.
Right. And then there's what's called the obesity paradox, which is past a certain age, you actually have a survival advantage if you're grossly obese, but if you're a little bit above, you're 10% above this optimal body weight. Just slightly high BMI.
Yeah, Joy's question is actually, is her high B12 a reason she can't gain weight?
No. High B12 is, and again, we have to revisit this question quite often, not a problem. It's like, you know, Donald Trump has an elevated bank account, you know, abnormally high. That's a good thing. Same thing with B12. Where it's a problem is when it's low. You virtually can't overdose on B12. So, you know, I was talking to one of our guests, and he's Dr. Salas. We did something on oligonol, and he's also a sports medicine guy. He takes a lot of B12, and he says, I personally have a B12 of 13,000. He was proud of it. I mean, that's way above normal. It's like 12 times, you know, normal. You know, it's not a problem. And it's certainly, first of all, it's not a problem, but it's also not why she's having problems with the weight.
Right. She says she's eating a very clean diet. So, Joy, if you do want to gain a few pounds, which should be fine if you're probably a larger frame or so, add a whey protein shake every day. Mm-hmm. Take some nice whey
protein.
Throw
in half an avocado. Put in a tablespoon or two of coconut oil.
Yep.
Those are great calorie sources and you know, really healthy.
And that could help you to gain weight.
Yeah.
And it's good for your muscles, too. The whey protein is good for your muscles. The branched chain amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
It can help boost glutathione. It's all good.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you for your question, Joy. Okay. We've got a question from Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
I've read that exercise can cause false positives for PSA levels.
Mm-hmm.
Some recommend that you should stop exercising for 1 week before retesting. Is that enough time for the PSA to settle down from exercise? Are some exercisers better for people on active surveillance? Mm-hmm. Ryan is on active surveillance. He's 64.
So let's explain a couple of things. Active surveillance means that he's been diagnosed with prostate cancer, but he hasn't undertaken radical treatment with surgery or with radiation implant, or you know, some of the other procedures. Now they have a freezing procedure as well. And so they're kind of just monitoring it, and they want to see if the PSA is going to go up, up, up. And if it does, then maybe he needs more treatment. But active holistic surveillance, I talked about in one of my series recently in our newsletter, and it's on our website, involves diet, supplements, and exercise. Exercise definitely can reduce the chances that early prostate cancer is going to progress. So, all right, so several questions embedded in there. It's like, does exercise affect PSA? Certain exercises, especially like cycling, you know, you're literally sitting on your prostate. That could be a problem. There's even some evidence that, you know, when you go for a routine doctor's office visit, they say, okay, let me examine your prostate. They do that, you know, snap the gloves on and, you know, do the rectal exam. And then they say, okay, now go for a blood test. It turns out that's not the right order. You should get the blood test before you mess around with the prostate, because you actually... when you manipulate the prostate, you release more PSA. So the other thing is that patients who are having the PSA are also encouraged to abstain from sex for, I don't know, anywhere 48 to 72 hours. Some men say that's impossible. I can't do that. But, you know, you got to do it, because otherwise you could actually, you're engaging the prostate, you know, through
Now, that's not common information. That's not common information.
Right.
And hopefully that's a question from a urologist. When is the last time you had sex?
Yes, because sometimes, they'll say, okay, well, your PSA is a little borderline. Make sure you are not sexually active, and this time I'm not going to examine you before the blood test. And, oh, by the way, are you a cyclist, you know, with those hard seats? I'm not sure that running can do that, but I guess that's conceivable that, you know, running can do it. Probably not to the extent that something where there's direct contact with your prostate. And, so there you have it.
Yeah. Ryan, thank you for that very, very excellent question, and best of luck to you.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, we have several patients under care here with doing active holistic surveillance with the approval of their urologist. So the urologist used to be really gung-ho about, you know, any sign of prostate cancer, treat it very aggressively, make sure it, you know, is nipped in the bud. Now they recognize that this can create more harm than good, and that many men who have early prostate cancer can be just monitored. And we're seeing great results. Our patients are, the PSAs are stable, they're even going down. Subsequent biopsies are negative, and it's all good.
Yeah. I've got a very important question here from an RN. I actually got it this morning, Dr. Hoffman, and I bumped it up to the front of the batch of questions.
Okay.
And thank you all for sending us your questions. Good evening, Dr. Hoffman. My name is Denise. I'm an RN working in a hospital in the tri-state area, and I've been told if I don't receive the flu shot, I must wear a mask while working from November 1 to March 31, or longer, depending on the severity of flu season. I will, because I don't want to wear a mask all this time, get the flu shot. What supplements can I take to protect myself from any side effects of this ineffective vaccine?
Right. So, okay, well, this is a predicament that is, I get it. What they're trying to do in the hospital is they have vulnerable patients there, and they don't want medical personnel infecting the patients. Unfortunately, it's an infringement on the personal rights of the medical people. But I think when you're in a field like that, you surrender some of your personal rights. So You know, I'm not in an acute care setting. I see patients on a consultative basis. I guess, you know, they're potentially at risk if I were fine, but carrying the virus, but I don't get the flu shot, and a lot of doctors don't, knowing what they know about adverse reactions and also the general ineffectiveness of the flu vaccine for a lot of people. So anyway, that's, yeah. Well, that's not what she's asking. She's saying, is there a way to mitigate the potential damage or to reduce the harmful effects? And I got to say that I'm not sure that there are supplements you can take to reduce your chances of having an adverse reaction to the flu vaccine. I know, however, that there are supplements you can take to increase your chances of responding to the flu vaccine, because that's actually been mm-hmm. demonstrated. And there are studies done, especially in older people. Older people often don't get proper immunity when they take the flu shot. And studies have shown that if they take vitamin E or vitamin C or selenium or even vitamin D before, the various studies have been done, that they're more likely to have a positive response. I would also hazard to say, I mean, there are other things that might be beneficial, like AHCC, which increases natural killer cell activity, or transfer factor. These are immune enhancers. Maybe, you know, various mushroom extracts might be helpful, or astragalus, or even echinacea. But I can't tell you that by taking those things, it's less likely that you're going to feel really crappy when you take the flu shot, or, you know, even have, you know, some people have, you know, pretty severe or devastating side effects. That's very rare, you know, like one in a million kind of thing.
What about helping to detoxify, you know, the other ingredients in a flu shot, maybe some NAC or something
that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. Thank you. That really does make sense, because, say, there's a vaccine that contains mercury, you know, things that help that would be N-acetylcysteine, selenium would help the body detox. You know, these are some of the things.
And the vitamin D as well, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. You know, so milk thistle, although, you know, that's more like a gas, like a, it removes toxins from the body.
Yeah. Denise, thank you for that very, very important question.
Yeah, we have time for one more question. Is there such a thing as a short question?
I have a short question.
Okay.
This comes from, I don't have a name. You have it's Brenda. You have indicated that curcumin is effective against breast cancer. Is turmeric equally effective, or should one replace turmeric with curcumin?
Well, the answer is, you know, turmeric, of course. I mean, you know the answer as well, Leila.
Yeah, turmeric, Brenda, is the spice where curcumin comes from. Mm-hmm. So by all means, take your curcumin, but do feel free to use turmeric in your cooking.
Yeah.
Put it in your scrambled eggs. Put it in your rice pilaf. You know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
definitely.
And part of the problem with turmeric is that turmeric is good, and one of the reasons we know that without taking curcumin, you'll get a benefit is that in India, where turmeric is used very extensively, there's a kind of a curious situation. They have a much lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease. Now, again, correlation is not causation. There may be other aspects of the Indian lifestyle that make them less likely to get Alzheimer's disease. But they've actually done studies that correlate the amount of turmeric that various Indians use and the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And it turns out there is some protection conferred by dietary turmeric, but they use a lot. They use it daily in, you know, literally handfuls, the big.
It's in curry. It's in curries. Having fish curry for breakfast, you know.
You're right. The big vats of turmeric at every outdoor market, beautiful colors in India. But part of the problem with turmeric is its bioavailability. And so there's now a hunt, that's underway to find better ways to deliver it so that it gets into the system, so that it gets into the brain, especially because it seems to help slow dementia. Cogumin is a product that we use. You know, we also use Mareva, which is nano encapsulated in a lipid capsule that makes it better absorbed. And so, I think it's a wonderful supplement to take. I take it every day. I think everybody should take some curcumin, either dietarily or, you know, in a supplement form, because it has so many benefits for the brain, anti-cancer, for the circulatory system, for the joints. It's great stuff.
Yeah. Thanks for your question, Brenda.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'll just remind our listeners that, you know, we talk about various supplements here on Intelligent Medicine, and this broadcast is free, and we love doing it. But we also would appreciate it if you took a look at the Hoffman Center store. You can find a link at drhoffman.com. Check it out, because we have great products at great prices and a fantastic service, personal service there. Shop at drhoffman.com for your supplement needs, and thereby ensure the continuity of this free information, which we're very happy to dispense. Thanks for joining us today, and thank you, Layla.
Thanks, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you, everybody.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
This is Layla Mutin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.